It's the 9th of March. I'm at the Hastings Public Library. We have our guest speaker at Landmark, Barbara Walker, the chaplain at the hospital.
Landmark's talks will carry on through to November, all being well. I won't take any more of your time other to introduce Barbara Walker. She's a mainlander like myself, so we're very connected. And she was born in Riverton, which has become the Monaco of New Zealand. And she trained at Green Lane Hospital. She has worked a great amount of her time overseas. She also holds a divinity ordinance from the Anglican Church. She now works as a chaplain at Hawke's Bay District Hospital, along with a team of six chaplains. We're going to cover mainly Thailand, Somalia, Pakistan and Zambia. And Barbara will outline her work there. But she has written this amazing book called Purple Hands. So in the meantime, please welcome Barbara Walker, and over to you, Barbara.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's lovely to be here. I was in the South Island, came back on Sunday. I've been down in central Otago doing a 6-day silent retreat, but I can still talk. But it was absolutely amazing. It was just wonderful to get back down to the South Island, and I encourage all of you to go down there and go to Riverton. I've actually managed to arrange an appointment to take two services on Stewart Island in December, the 5th and the 12th, so I'll be going down there. And I thought if that works out well, then I might sort of have 6 months in Stewart Island, 6 months in Hawke's Bay. But anyway, it's lovely to be here, and thank you for the invitation to come and share a little bit with this very amazing group of people who are working so hard to record stories of people who have made contributions in Hawke's Bay. So I feel incredibly privileged to be here tonight. I was born in Riverton, right down the bottom of the South Island, and my parents were school teachers, and we shifted all over New Zealand. Every 2 to 3 years, Dad was always a headmaster, and so we started off in Riverton, and we lived at the Riverton Rocks, and we were in rented accommodation, so when holidays came, we had to shift out of our crib down there, and we kept moving around. I'm one of 6 children, 5 girls and a boy. And then my parents decided to go to Millerton. Does anybody know where Millerton is? Wow. Millerton was a coal mining town. You go to Westport, then you go up the coast to Granity, and then you wind up this terrible, terrible dirt one-track road, but now it's quite a big highway, and up to Millerton, which was a coal mining town. So I started school there, and my dad was my teacher. Then after a few years, Dad decided, let's go to the North Island. So we loaded up our Morris Oxford, no seat belts, no car seats, 3-4 of us in the front and 3 in the back, and off we went to Macquarie. Does anybody know where Macquarie is? No? We'll have a geography lesson. Macquarie is just outside Hara in Taranaki. And Dad was the headmaster there. And yeah, at that stage there was 5 girls. My brother hadn't come then. So I spent a lot of time working on a sheep farm, even though I was about 10 at the time. I really loved getting out with this guy called Clary. And Clary's daughter was a very good friend of mine. And I spent hours and hours out with Clary learning how to deliver sheep and all about sheep. And in the book, you'll read about how some of those techniques I learned to deliver sheep helped when I was working as a midwife in Pakistan, delivering complex cases of women who'd come across the border from Afghanistan with prolapsed uteruses. So there's a connection between sheep and my midwifery skills. We then went up to Portland. Anyone know where Portland is? Near Whangarei, yes, up to there, and it was a cement town, Again, Dad was the headmaster, and at one stage there was three walkers in the class, and that's when strapping was still in vogue. And Dad used to have a big strap about that wide, and for the first 3 weeks, anyone who stepped over the line got the cuts. And then after that, he put it away. It was really hard being the headmaster's kids because we had expectations to, you know, a bit like the vicar's kids or the police kids. But while we were in Portland, Mum and Dad got the combination right, and my brother was born. And it was probably the first time I've ever seen my father cry. He took Mum into the hospital in Whangarei and then came home, because that's what you did then. The phone rang about an hour later, and Dad started crying, and we thought, goodness, Mum's died. But no, his son had arrived. So then I started high school at Whangarei Girls, and then Dad said, right, no, we've got to move south. So we went to Ohaupo. You people must know where that is, just outside Hamilton. And I went to Melville High School. While I was up living in Portland, I went to a Christian camp one Easter. And I really felt God was calling me to go overseas and be a missionary nurse. I'm the first nurse in our family. All our family are teachers. And so I remember going home and saying to Mum, one day I'm going to be a missionary nurse. And she said to me, yes, dear, that's lovely. I'll be a air hostess next week and a hairdresser the other week. But it was a call that really stayed with me. And in 1970, I applied and was accepted to train at Green Lane Hospital as a nurse. So I went up there, and that was the days that Barrett Boys was working, and it was a big heart hospital. And so we had people from all over New Zealand flown up to Green Lane Hospital. And I've actually had the privilege of meeting some people here in Hawke's Bay who went up to Auckland for heart surgery as children. Yeah, it was a real privilege to work there. And they were also linked with Christian Barnard work in South Africa. So I did my training at Green Lane Hospital and then did my midwifery at St. Helens in Auckland. And then my friend said to me, well, Barbara, if you're going to go overseas and be a missionary, you sort of need to get a bit of theology. And so I went over to a Bible college in Australia. And while I was there, as well as theology and church history, I also learned car mechanics, plumbing and carpentry. Came back to New Zealand and applied to a mission society to go to Thailand. I have dyslexia, and so the possibility of learning a foreign language was not in my, it was just not going to happen. So this mission society put me through 6 language tests, 3 at the university and 3 that they were doing. And they said to me, Barbara, you will never learn a foreign language. Stay home, support your friends. But being someone who's quite determined, I knew that God called me and I knew that I would go. And 10 days later, I was driving home from work, and Merv Smith, remember Merv Smith, 1ZB, was asking for nurses and doctors to volunteer to go out to the Thai-Cambodian border. This was when Pol Pot was in power and was massacring thousands and thousands of people. Rob Muldoon was the Prime Minister, so he spoke to Air New Zealand, and Air New Zealand flew up the first medical team, and I was on that. There was about 5 nurses and a couple of doctors. So we left civilized New Zealand and flew to Bangkok, and then went up by bus to a place called Sakeo 1. Sakeo 1 was a refugee camp. There were 35,000 people, all dressed in black. Under the Pol Pot's regime in Cambodia, anyone who showed any form of emotion was killed. So for years, these people went through hell. And I remember walking into that camp and seeing all the, like, imagine everyone in this room dressed in black, just sitting, staring. And that was children as well. There were 35,000 people. And these people had been traumatized. Many of them had seen their loved ones killed. It was unbelievable. My girlfriend and I was working for World Vision at the time. We were asked to do night duty. We had a ward of about 120 patients. The majority of them had cerebral malaria. Our interpreters that night were Pol Pot soldier girls. Now these were girls that were soldiers in Pol Pot's army, and I'm sure as well as being soldiers, probably many of them had been soldiers. We won't go into the details. I'm sure that you can understand what I'm saying. And it was really difficult. They were our interpreters. They didn't speak English. We didn't speak Khmer or Thai. So it was sign language. And that night we lost about 30 patients. That was the introduction for me into disaster relief nursing. During the evening, we wrote a letter to Rob Muldoon to thank him for flying us up. But each time someone died, we had to stop and go and attend to them. So in this camp, there was a whole lot of relief agencies. We had the Israeli medics next door. So the patients came and they were screened by them, and then they came to our wards. So I worked there for a number of months, and then World Vision asked me if I would go with a group of others nearer the border to a place called Khao Yai. Khao Yai, when we arrived, was just like huge big football fields with a whole lot of blue plastic bamboo, and we had to build our hospital. It's interesting working at Hawke's Bay Hospital and the discussions now about building a new hospital. We built a hospital there of 1,500 beds in a matter of about 6 weeks. They weren't made of concrete and we didn't have electricity, but we had bamboo and plastic sheeting. So in the time I was there, the population went from zero to 120,000 people. So that would almost be the whole of Hawke's Bay living in a refugee camp. As I said, our hospital was 1,500 bed. We had teams of people flying in from around the world. The German Air Force flew in a complete operating theatre and set it up. And we had lots of other agencies that were helping. We used to get truckloads of people coming in from the border who were very, very badly traumatised and injured. There was no helicopters, there was no ambulance. So they would come in the back of the trucks and they would be triaged. Those that were likely to die within the next 5 minutes were just left. Those that, with some rapid intervention, were treated, and those that maybe were relatively minor would have to wait. The German medical team set up this incredible operating theatre, and we had patients coming in who's still on landmines, people coming in with no legs, no arms, people with cerebral malaria, people totally and utterly traumatised. Around our camp of 120,000 people was a barbed wire fence to keep the refugees in, and anyone who caught escaping was shot. We saw a Cambodian person shot outside the ward of our hospital one day. So it was a pretty tough place to work in. We had a lot of celebrities fly in. We had a lot of kings and queens from around the world flew in to see what was going on. It was a crisis that was very near us, and New Zealand responded incredibly well. After my time there, World Vision asked me if I would go down to Singapore and go on the boat Sea Sweep around the South China Sea, rescuing boat people who were escaping from Vietnam. So I went on this boat, and for 6 weeks we sailed around the South China Sea, rescuing people who had basically got into fishing boats that normally went up the Mekong River, and they were escaping because of the fighting that was going on in North and South Vietnam. And they were getting onto these boats, which legally probably held 10 people, but up to 100 people got onto these boats, and they headed out into the South China Sea, no radios, no life jackets, just basically nothing, escaping. A lot of them died. Nobody knows how many hundreds of thousands of people drowned, and also how many the pirates got and killed. I had the privilege of being on the boat during that time, and we rescued 252 people, going alongside these fishing boats and then reaching down and helping these people climb up rope ladders onto our ship. We took them down to the hull of the ship and we gave them food and water and medication. And to me, it was one of the most moving things I've ever done, was to rescue these people. If we hadn't found them, then who knows what would have happened. These people went to islands in Indonesia where they were screened, and then they went to different countries around the world. Some came here, some went to Australia. This was the beginning of the boat people. Then I came back to New Zealand and spent about 4 weeks at Green Lane Hospital, but got severely told off by the night supervisor because one morning we had a cardiac arrest, and the doctor came and was doing a mouth-to-mouth, and the supervisor was doing cardiac massage, and the doctor yelled out, put a drip in. So I put a drip in And the next night when I went to work, the supervisor said to me, "Staff nurse Walker, nurses do not put drips in. Where did you learn this?" I said, "Thailand." She said, "Well, this isn't Thailand." So I went home and thought, what am I going to do? But I got a phone call in the middle of the afternoon from World Vision asking me if I'd go to Somalia. Now, I'm sure there is no one in this room who's ever visited Somalia. Somalia is in the Horn of Africa, and it's a country that often has no government, it has no tax, it has no immigration, it has nothing basically, except warlords and guns, and it makes the news every now and then when they hijack the oil ships that are going up and down outside. So I flew to Somalia, into Mogadishu, which is the capital, and at the airport there is nothing in any of my passports that said I've actually been there, because there was no one to stamp my passport. And when you arrive there, you were met with utes with AK-47s on the back, and you were escorted to wherever you were going. It's a bit more exciting than landing at Napier Airport. I haven't seen any AK-47s here. So I joined the team. We were working in a place called Hargeisa. Hargeisa was out in the northern part of Somalia. And they go for a few hours out into the desert and set up a camp called Los Dure. Months and months and months I worked there. We had a camp with 80,000 people, all living under blue plastic sheeting. We had 26,000 children who were incredibly malnourished, and we had to set up a feeding program. So to set up a feeding program, you need to get water. And unfortunately, not like Hawke's Bay, we can go and turn on the tap. You have to go to the river and you've got to dig down. And when you do find water, it's brown. And the river's there and the feeding centres are there. So how do you get your water from there to the feeding centres? And when there's no pipe, there's no generator, you had donkeys. So we had donkeys with kerosene tins. And we had men who got the donkeys to walk up. And then we had to build feeding centres so these kids could sit and be fed porridge and high energy biscuits and milk. So my skills at Bible College about building came in handy. During my time there, at one stage we had 5 nurses and no doctor. But gradually, as word got out that the situation was really in crisis, they managed to send some paediatricians from America and Germany, and gradually we began to build up a team. We had a real problem in the camp with trachoma. That's when eyelashes go in on the eye and rub up and down, you can go blind. So a guy called Jock Anderson, who was an eye surgeon in England, came out to Mogadishu and sent a message on a plane. This is before texts, before emails, before cell phones, before satellite phones, to say that he was running a training centre. So Julia, one of the Australian doctors, and I went down and learned how to do this operation. So we came back and thought, okay, we need to start operating. Now again, it's interesting working at Hawke's Bay Hospital, because at the moment they're putting in a brand new theatre. I think it's taking 2 to 3 years and it's going to cost $20 million. We put up a tent. We had a table of it like that, a bit longer. We had a primus to cook the instruments. We had a book on how to do it. We had local anaesthetic, and we needed 2 interpreters. So we found Abdi and Abdi. They were young Somali guys, probably about 13, 14 years of age, who had basic English, so they were our interpreters. We used to operate regularly during the day, and they began to say to us, "Would you be able to teach us how to do this operation?" Julie and I looked at each other and thought, we're going to leave here, they're going to stay. So we trained them to do it. And I often think when I tell that story, if I went to Hastings Boys High School tomorrow and selected 2 14 or 15 year old guys and took them up to the theatre at Hawke's Bay, where cataracts and eye operations are happening, I think the news item would be a wee bit different than maybe our current ones. After my time in Somalia, World Vision were going to set up a disaster team to respond to emergencies, so they asked me if I would go to England and do some courses in tropical medicine, disaster management, refugee health. So I did, and I went to Liverpool and did tropical medicine. And while I was there one Sunday at a church service, the vicar stood up and said, "Say hello to the person beside you." So I stood up, said hello, and this was a girl, Joan, who had come back from Pakistan. She was a midwife. She'd caught typhoid and had come home. And she said to me, "Barbara, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I've just done tropical medicine, but I don't have a job." She said, "Why don't you go to Pakistan?" And I said, "I don't have any money." She said, "Don't worry, three phone numbers. When you get down to London, ring the number." So I got down to London. At that stage in the world, there was almost no disasters. So World Vision delayed in setting up the emergency team. So I was literally out of work. So I went to the Church Missionary Society in London, and they said, "Yes, we desperately need a nurse in Pakistan, on the Afghan-Pakistan border." So out I went. In 1979, the Russians had invaded Afghanistan, and the Americans were supporting the Mujahideen. The Taliban hadn't been invented. So I spent 5.5 years working in a mission hospital on the border between Pakistan, tribal area, Afghanistan. And during my 5.5 years, 3.5 million refugees poured out of Afghanistan across into Pakistan. So I worked in this hospital. We had a most amazing gynecologist, obstetrician from England, a lady called Ruth Coggan. When I got there, I said to Ruth, "Can you please teach me everything you know about obstetrics?" And she did. And as I said earlier, we had women coming in on the back of Land Rovers, on the back of Datsuns. We had Afghan women walking across the border with ruptured uteruses, prolapsed arms. If any of you are nurses or midwives, there's a famous book called Maggie Miles. And in it, Maggie says you can do this, this, and this, and then you need to call the flying squad. Well, out in Pakistan, we were the flying squad. Yeah, I loved the work, but I found it really hard working in a very conservative culture. Our nearest city was Peshawar, and then from Peshawar you go south to Banu. It was an amazing place to work in, but it was very hard. But I learned a huge amount doing obstetrics. I did my first and only craniotomy in Banu. Ruth was on holiday and this lady came in very advanced labour. I examined her and realised that the baby she was about to deliver was a hydrocephalic, which meant it had a very large head. Now, in New Zealand, you wouldn't get babies like that now because they would have had scans, but in Pakistan we didn't. So I asked a couple of my colleagues who were there, could they examine her? And they said to me, "Yes, Barbara, your diagnosis is right." So my choice was to do nothing and to lose the mother with a ruptured uterus and the baby. The other choice was to do a craniotomy, to release the pressure in the baby's head, which would kill the baby, but we would be able to deliver the baby and the mother would be fine. What a choice to make. We chose to do the craniotomy and the baby died, and a few days later the mother walked out and walked back to Afghanistan. We also had a number of babies that were bright yellow and we needed to do exchange transfusions on them. This was when Prof. Lyley and some of the others were doing intrauterine transfusions on the babies at Auckland Hospital. I'm ORH negative, the universal donor, so I donate the blood. And then with Ruth, the obstetrician gynecologist, we would put a catheter into the baby around the umbilicus, take blood out, give them my blood, take blood out, give them my blood. I donated quite a lot of blood in Pakistan. It's interesting, I could donate blood in Pakistan, but I can't donate blood in New Zealand because I was in England during the mad cow disease. During my time in Pakistan, Ruth went on leave and World Vision contacted me and asked me if I'd go to Ethiopia. This was the big famine in 84-85, and again went out to a place called Idnat. It was a camp that had been burnt down by the Marxist government, and the people escaped up into the hills, and when they got up there, cholera broke out. So I arrived in that camp with all these people coming down out of the hills into a cholera epidemic outbreak. We had 1,000 people. We had no gowns, we had no gloves, we had no PPE equipment. And it was really interesting last year working at the hospital during COVID and seeing all the gowns and gloves and masks which staff needed and we needed. But just to think what we did in Ethiopia all those years ago, and none of our 1,000 patients died. After my time in Ethiopia, I went back to Pakistan, and then I was asked to go down to Zambia, to the Copper Belt, a place called Mpongwe. It was a mission hospital funded by the Swedish government, but the money was given to a Swedish mission. So the hospital was pretty well equipped, 120 beds, and sometimes we had doctors from Sweden and England, and sometimes we didn't. It was during my time there that I came across HIV/AIDS. We had 120 beds, as I said, mainly adult patients, and probably 92% of them were HIV positive or who had AIDS. So it was a very tough place to work. This is pre-antiretroviral drug time. So basically, if you were diagnosed as being positive with HIV or you had AIDS, your life expectancy was probably 2 to 3 years. We had surgeons coming from Sweden and doing surgery, and we had one guy came once and he said, "Barbara, I want to do some surgery to amputate someone's leg. We need to do a mastectomy on somebody else and we're doing a cesarean." I said, "What's the anesthetic?" Because I was only used to spinals in Pakistan. And he said, "Ketamine." I said, "What's ketamine?" He said, "Here you are, here's the book, read it. Be in the operating theatre tomorrow, you're my anaesthetist." So, in true Kiwi fashion, I stayed up all night, read the book, thought I knew what I was doing, went into theatre, and we're going to amputate this old man's leg first. And so, put the drip in, and I think that I probably gave him a bit too much ketamine, and he had a respiratory arrest, so we had to stop. He recovered, so that operation was cancelled. Then we started the mastectomy. And probably about 10 minutes into the operation, I just noticed that the lady was just moving a wee bit. So I said to the surgeon, "Let's stop," and the drip of tissue, put the drip back in. Everything went fine. The operation went well. And then we had to do the cesarean. Now that is really tricky, because you need to make the mother sleeping unconscious, but you also got a baby inside. So much prayer went up, and it was sort of a bit of a balance. But anyway, we managed to sedate the mum, got the baby out, and then gave the mum more sedation. Probably a wee bit too much, because normally you wake up sort of about half an hour to an hour afterwards. She woke up about 3 hours later. But she had a lovely baby boy, so she was delighted. Then we had a doctor who was pulling teeth, because out there there was no dentist, so basically the people had a lot of broken teeth and roots, and these people were say HIV positive. So Anthony, the doctor, was going home on leave. There was no other doctor in the hospital. And he said to me, "Barbara, you need to learn how to pull teeth." So through Kiwi fashion, we learned how to do anesthetic at the top and bottom. And I spent many, many, many afternoons digging out broken teeth, digging out roots on patients who were all HIV positive. I had like a crash helmet on, the same sort of plastic screen that we were using at Hawke's Bay Hospital. This was back in 1991. We had these plastic helmets in Zambia, and they had them in Hawke's Bay and all around the country, all around the world. Everyone had these plastic things on during COVID. So during my time in Zambia, a friend said to me, "Barbara, you've got all this experience. You need to go and do a degree." And I thought, no, I just scraped through school C. I got UE because they wanted me to be head girl. And I said, no, no, no. So I had a bit of time. So I went to England and spoke to Brunel University about doing a degree in medical anthropology. And they said, yes, yes, yes. I think it was because I was a foreign student and I was going to be paying a lot of money. So anyway, I had about 6 months to fill in before I started at this Brunel University in London. So I went and worked on the Tanzanian-Rwandan border, setting up an HIV/AIDS program for World Vision. And then went to university and started my, I did a master's. I thought, I'm not starting with a bachelor's, I'll just start with a master's. And I remember my first day going to a lecture on social anthropology, and I didn't understand a word that was saying. And so I thought I'd better go out and get a dictionary. So I went out and got a dictionary, but I got the wrong dictionary. I should have got an anthropological dictionary, not the Oxford dictionary. And at this big university, we had a library and they had computers. I'd never seen a computer because you didn't have computers in Somalia or Ethiopia or Pakistan. And so after about 3 days, the librarian said to me, Barbara, where do you come from? And I said, I'm from New Zealand, but I've been working in the bush. So she was very patient. So during my time there, I went back out to Tanzania to do my research. I was looking at the impact of AIDS on a community in Tanzania, on the Tanzania-Rwandan border, so Rwanda, Uganda, Tanzania. And I visited families who had been absolutely devastated by AIDS. So many of the parents of these children, aged, say, from 18 to 45, had died of AIDS. And suddenly the grandparents, now probably most of you in this room are grandparents, I know you love your grandchildren, but would you like to get a phone call saying that your children have died and your 20 grandchildren are coming to stay with you forever? Because this is what happened in Tanzania. The parents had died and these children, aged from babies to maybe teenagers, suddenly had nowhere to go. So these elderly people were suddenly looking after all these children, hundreds and thousands of children. Also, while I was in Tanzania, we tried to set up HIV/AIDS programs. We didn't have a hospice, and people who were dying of AIDS were nursed at home on the floor with banana leaves, no pain relief. And I remember going one day to visit this house, and we knocked on the door, and a five-year-old daughter came to the door. She was the carer for her dying father. The mother had left, and there was about an 18-month-old baby, and this five-year-old girl was looking after her dad. She couldn't, you know, she wasn't strong enough to even sit him up. We were able to give some help to the neighbour who sort of looked after this really dying man and these two little kids. While I was there in Tanzania, this was the beginning of the massacre in Rwanda between the Hutus and the Tutsis, and thousands of people came across the border into Tanzania. And one day we went down to the big Banakwa camp, 850,000 people poured across the border, across the bridge, into this camp. And as we drove through the camp, here were the people walking, carrying everything they owned. People who were so tired and so sick, they just lay down on the road. Women who were in labour sat down, squatted, delivered, got up. 850,000 people, and probably of those 20 or 30,000 were children. You know, you might think it's hard when you go to Kmart on Christmas Eve with your grandchildren, but you try walking through these huge, huge camps. So I said to the Tanzanian staff, let's go near the, there was a bridge, Tanzanian, Rwanda. The Tanzanian guards were on this side, the Rwandan guards were on that side. So I went up to the guard with my interpreter and said, could I go and stand on the bridge? So this is the bridge which Kagera River flows under and flows into Lake Victoria. And I stood on that bridge that day and looked down into the water, and here were bodies tied together with spears in them. They'd been killed floating down the river. And there was this body of this probably a 2 or 3 year old kid naked jammed into the rocks. And I said to my interpreter, we have to get that body, you know. He said, Barbara, you can't. So I stood on the bridge that day and had a conversation with God, saying, how come human beings can do this to each other? During that time of the massacre, 40,000 bodies floated down the Kagera River into Lake Victoria. Lake Victoria is huge. It makes Taupo look like a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's an enormous lake. But around the lake, Uganda, Tanzania and Kenya have fishing companies, because in Lake Victoria you get Nile perch that are this big, and they get filleted and sent to Europe for the people in Europe to buy. When 40,000 bodies floated into Lake Victoria, nobody wanted to buy fish. The hostel I stayed in was on the shores of Lake Victoria, and it was pretty devastating to be there. I finished my degree and then went and worked in Tanzania as their HIV/AIDS consultant, working with truck drivers and prostitutes in the middle of the night, talking to them about HIV and AIDS with the World Vision team. I was then asked to go down to Mozambique. Mozambique had just come out of 17 years of civil war and it had just joined the Commonwealth. And so I went down there and headed up a medical program in a place called Tet. I'm sure no one here has been to Tet. It's not exactly on the tourist map. So I worked there on a World Vision team, and we were incredibly, wonderfully supported by the people of New Zealand, who gave money to World Vision for the projects I was involved in. I'd been there 7 months, and one day there was a knock on the door, and our armed guards brought a note on a piece of paper. And written on that note, "Fine, my senior Mozambican staff didn't raise the salary of our general Mozambican staff, I and them would be killed by the end of the year." Now, I don't know if any of you in this room have ever received a death threat. It is incredibly scary because you don't know who wrote it. So we went to the local police, who were trained by Eastern Europe governments, and we were told to bring a piece of paper, a light bulb and a pen, because they didn't have that. So we went down and spoke to them, and they said, "Well, what we can do is we can arrest all the people, Barbara, that you work with." That was the whole of the medical team, which was 30 people. So they were all interviewed, and the chief policeman said to me, "Make a list of who you think did it." After interviewing all the team, I refused to give a list because that would put me in more danger. So he said to me one day, "Well, I've arrested everyone, I've spoken to them, the only way I can find out who did it would be to beat it out of them, because that's what they did there." So I said, "No, no." He said, "Well, you need to come down because I need to interview you." And I'm thinking, what is this? So I refused. And then it got nearer and nearer to the end of the year. Probably in about August, I went down to Zimbabwe and spoke to the New Zealand High Commissioner there, walked into his office, said, "This is what we want to do. We want to set up a program to educate women and feed the children when the women come for classes." And I walked out with a large sum of money and we set the program up. But as the year went by and as each month passed by, it just got more and more difficult for me to be there. I didn't want to let the people of New Zealand down. I didn't know what would happen if I left, but I also knew that I couldn't carry on working. Wherever I went, I had armed guards, and it just got untenable for me to stay. So I rang the World Vision boss here in Auckland, and he arranged for me to fly down to South Africa, where I met the big Southern Africa boss, who basically said to me, "Barbara, we've got to get you out." So I went back. He said, "Go to work on Monday, say nothing to anyone, and then the car will come and pick you up in the morning, and we'll take you to Harare and fly you home." So that's what happened. So I left Mozambique with one suitcase and came back to New Zealand pretty traumatized. There was no such thing as post-traumatic stress. Came back to New Zealand and thought, what am I going to do? Where am I going to work? I wanted somewhere where I could make a difference. I wanted somewhere that was sort of third worldish. So I applied for a position in the Hokianga in Northland and spent 3.5 years working out there with the local people in their community. Then down to Milton in Otago, working in a health trust there. And then I managed Red Roos Retirement Home in Dunedin. But I'd lost my passion for nursing, because in New Zealand you've got to abide by the Nursing Council and the Midwifery Council. And so I was driving to Te Anau one day with Bishop Penny, and Bishop Penny said to me, "Barbara, what are you going to do when you finish nursing?" And I said, "I want to become a hospital chaplain." So that began a long process of going through ordination into the Anglican Church. In 2009, I started working as the lead chaplain in Hawke's Bay Hospital. So I've just completed 12 years. It's the longest I've ever lived in my life. I've spoken at many, many groups, many, many conferences around New Zealand, and people said to me, Barbara, you need to write a book. So just think, full-time work, having dyslexia, I thought, I'm going to do it. So for the last probably 6 years, working with some very good friends, through blood, sweat, toil, every time I had holidays, every time I had a weekend, this book was finally birthed. And in July last year, I launched it at Toi Toi. And yeah, it was an incredible day. I remember when it arrived at my house, all these boxes of my books, and I picked it up and burst into tears and thought, man. When I was working in the Hokianga, I received a letter from Sir Michael Hardy Boys. And I don't know about you, if I get anything official from the government or Government House, I'm thinking, my goodness, what have I done? But it was actually a letter from Sir Michael Hardy Boys saying that Her Majesty the Queen wanted to give me a Queen's Service Order for my work overseas. So on my birthday, 9th of August 2000, I went down to Government House, got all poshed up, and was there when I received my medal. And receiving it that day, I received it on behalf of all the national staff that I've worked with, because if it hadn't been for them, I wouldn't have been able to do what I did. I'm working with my publisher at the moment about turning my book into an audiobook, because I have to confess today, I've read the chapters, but I haven't actually read the book, because for me to sit down and read it is really quite hard. But I will certainly be out in the garden listening to Purple Hands when the audiobook comes. So at the moment I'm working with my publisher and a company in Auckland who are finding three actresses who will read part of the book, and then I decide which one I want, and then we get it done as an audiobook. So my plan is to retire from Hawke's Bay Hospital at the end of August, because I turn 70 in August, and I'm very aware that none of us know how much longer we have on this earth. But having been to a friend's funeral today who was younger than me, who was diagnosed with a tumour in December, and I went to her funeral today, it's like it's time actually to have some Barbara time. The hospital at Hawke's Bay, as you probably know, we've been pretty short staffed with chaplains. We're not employed by the DHB, we're employed by the Interchurch Council for Hospital Chaplaincy in Wellington, but the DHB here are very supportive of chaplaincy service, as are the Hastings District Council. So over the last year, we've managed to employ three new chaplains. It's interesting, we've employed three basically to do my job, but that's okay, that's okay. So that's my story so far. That's the first 70 years. I went to a friend's 100th birthday in Havelock North recently, and driving home I'm thinking, my goodness, Barbara, 30 years time, people will be coming to your 100th birthday. I nearly drove off the road. I won't tell you what I said, but it was like, man. So what I encourage all of you here tonight to do is to record your story, because all of you have a story. That's my story, but you've all got a story. All of you in this room have contributed something. And it's too late when we gather around and there's a coffin in front and everyone tells amazing stories of all these people, but everybody goes, I didn't know that, I didn't know that. So I encourage you to get out and tell your story. Tell your story to your children. Get it recorded, because this is history. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, but I realise we've got to stop.
I think we'll have a round of applause first. And I think we can see, Barbara, why you earned your QSN, and I'm pleased it was acknowledged, because a lot aren't. Do you want to know why the book is called Purple Hands?
Yes. You have to buy the book.
Okay, someone else will tell you. So I just want to finish with asking any of you, before we let Barbara go, is there anything special you'd love to ask her?
Do you think
I only survived because of my faith and because of the call God put on my life. Without him, I wouldn't have made it. I saw people who came and did AIDS, you know, relief and disaster. It's a horrendous place to work in. And you've got to have something to hang on to. And for me, it was my faith, which at times was pretty shaky because you see so much suffering. But you also saw the difference that you could make. Mother Teresa said, someone said to her, you know, what you do is a drop in the ocean. But she said, many drops make an ocean. And if all of us seek to make a difference where we are, then we can make a difference in New Zealand and in the world. Medical anthropology is looking at illness, sickness and health in different cultures and what's important. So we did quite a big semester on the Inuit people and how their whole culture has been changed because they were sort of gathered up and taken and put into civilization and towns. And we also studied quite a lot of the impact of colonialism on Africa, particularly with Western medicine. So it was a fantastic course. We do anthropology in New Zealand, but not medical, unfortunately. But for me, it was fantastic because the lecturers would say, you know, so-and-so in this book says this. And I would say, but my experience in Somalia was this. I think they sort of got a bit. Because they did only go out for a few weeks and then they came back and were experts. I mean, I'd actually been there on the ground. And yeah, but that's what medical anthropology is.
You're all very satisfied, Barbara. It's been fantastic. Thank you. Thank you on behalf of Landmarks for that, Barbara.